Hello and welcome to the CAV podcast. There are major infrastructure schemes happening all over the UK, such as trunk road improvements in Scotland, new gas mains in Northern Ireland, electricity cables to connect wind farms in Wales and HS2 in England. So more and more property owners are being affected by the compulsory purchase of their land. Compulsory purchase can be a complicated and long drawn out process. But once the scheme is confirmed and a landowner knows that their property is going to be acquired, there are a number of steps that claimants and their advisors can take in order to prepare for the transaction, just as they would prepare for a voluntary sale on the open market. Here to discuss those steps is Kate Russell of the CAV. Welcome, Kate. Now, we're talking about this topic because you think that it's a part of the compulsory purchase process which can sometimes get overlooked by claimants.
Yes, Aled, that's right. The prospect of having your property acquired by compulsory purchase is often, understandably, very stressful for those affected. And there's a huge amount for them to deal with. They might have objected to the scheme, tried to get changes to the route. They might be negotiating measures to mitigate the impact of the scheme on their property or planning how to relocate a business. So there'll always be a lot going on, and often over many months or even years. When it gets to the point where you know that the property is going to be purchased, you just want that then to go ahead smoothly so that compensation's paid quickly. But sometimes this really critical point is delayed, and so the payment of the compensation's delayed if the landowner isn't fully prepared for that transaction to take place.
So let's have a look at some of the issues that you think are the most important to consider here. What's the first item on your list?
Well, the first item sounds pretty obvious, actually, Aled. It's about accurately identifying the claimant's interest. Now, in this podcast, we're mostly going to be discussing rural land and property, typically farms and rural estates. And the ownership and occupation of property, particularly rural property, which is often owned by families over several generations, can be complex and it isn't always clear. The ownership of the freehold might not be in the names of the people who occupy the property or run the business on it. But in order to confirm who's entitled to make a claim and also to enable the conveyance of the land, it's essential to confirm exactly who owns the property, who occupies it, and on what basis.
So starting with land ownership then, there are a number of different ways that property can be owned. So can you take us through those?
Yes. In the context of rural land and property, we typically come across several different types of ownership. So you'll have sole freehold ownership as probably the most straightforward, where the property is held by one individual. You might have joint ownership, where the property is held by husband and wife or several siblings, for example. The property might be held in a trust for beneficiaries. If a landowner has recently died, the land might be held by the executors of the deceased estate. Or it could be that the owner is a limited company or a charitable body. Now, the reason this matters is because, firstly, both the claimant and the acquiring authority need to know exactly who it is who's entitled to make the claim. And then secondly, the claimant needs to know that everybody who will be needed to sign papers or approve the deal has been identified and briefed to be ready for that.
I notice you haven't mentioned partnerships there, Kate, and family partnerships are very common in farming businesses. So how do they fit in?
Yes, good point. Partnerships are a bit of a special case. In Scotland, a partnership can have a legal entity, but in England, Wales and Northern Ireland, it can't. So the partnership can't own land or be a tenant in those countries. And we're just going to focus on this for a moment for partnerships in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. The ownership of the land or the tenancy might be in the name of some or all of the individuals within the partnership. But what can happen with family partnerships in particular is that new partners join the partnership, become involved in running the business, but they don't always buy a share in the property at the same time. In fact, the property might be held outside the partnership altogether. over time, the ownership and occupation of the property can diverge. But the current members of the partnership might not always appreciate what the position is. Often people don't have to think about these things until circumstances force them to. And the same issue can apply to tenancies. So the original partners held the tenancy, but new partners have been taken into the business over time and not necessarily into the tenancy itself.
So in that kind of situation, how can you work out what the actual position is?
The claimant and their advisors are going to need to check the facts and get hold of the key documents, such as title information or the tenancy agreement, and importantly, the partnership agreement. Some of those are going to be needed anyway in order to be able to prove that the claimant is eligible to claim. So it's best to find those early on so that everyone's clear about the facts and they also know where those documents are when they're needed later on.
And are there any other things to look out for when dealing with a partnership?
Oh, yes, all sorts of issues can arise. Typically, things like there is no written partnership agreement. That's not uncommon. Or there's an old agreement, but it no longer reflects the current facts, partly what we've just been talking about. It can be that the partners have changed some of the terms of the agreement, but those haven't really been properly recorded in writing. Then you've got issues about the land and buildings that are being used by the farming business. Are they partnership property or owned personally outside the partnership? And if the property is owned personally, but it's occupied by the partnership, on what basis is that occupation? Is it a formal lease or a license? And if there's no retirement clause, then the Partnership Act 1890, Section 33, takes over, so that on the death of one of the partners, the original partnership ceases and must be wound up. And that also applies if there's no written agreement. The important point here in all of these kind of areas is that if any of these partnership issues are spotted early on, everyone's got time to deal with them. So when it comes to the point where the property is being transferred to the acquiring authority, that transaction can proceed as smoothly as possible. If these sorts of problems are ignored or overlooked, then they risk delaying things later on. And that, of course, will include delaying the payment of compensation.
So plenty of potential issues to be aware of when dealing with a partnership then. But what else is on your checklist?
Next, I would want to check whether there are any restrictions on the ownership of the property, particularly where they might involve third parties having rights to it or over it. And the typical things you might come across could include mortgages or other loans secured on the land, where minerals or sporting rights are being owned or used by third parties. You might have easements in favour of third parties, restrictive covenants attaching to the property. There could be planning restrictions. There might be private rights of way. And if any of those are found, it might be necessary to involve a third party in the transaction. Or it may be that those third-party rights can be bought out or extinguished if necessary.
And you mentioned tenancies earlier on, Kate, and again, you'll often come across those. So what advice can you give on them?
Yes, there can be all sorts of different types of occupation on a rural property. So you might find tenancies of agricultural land or commercial lettings or residential property, and those are likely to be subject to some form of statutory framework. You might have licenses, such as grazing and mowing agreements, or you could have service occupancies, where someone occupies part of the property in connection with their employment. Now, you would hope that all of those types of arrangement would be recorded in writing, but of course, sometimes they aren't, in which case you might need to gather other evidence to confirm what the exact position is. Informal arrangements among family members can be tricky. They might have begun as one arrangement, but they can be at risk of evolving into something different over time through the actions of the parties. An example of that might be where a family member occupies a cottage rent-free on a short-term basis, but ends up staying there and then starts paying rent. So have they now got a tenancy? When did it arise? What's the legal protection that comes with it? Another one that we need to watch out for is if there are estranged or divorcing spouses. Spouses may have matrimonial home rights. And really, there are two main points here. Firstly, identifying who the various occupiers are so they can be kept informed about the compulsory purchase process. And then secondly, the important point of clarifying who it is who's entitled to make a claim. In some cases, a tenant might be eligible to make their own claim, but in other cases, and depending on the terms of the agreement, it could be for the landowner to claim for losses caused by the scheme and then to deal separately with the effect of the scheme on their contracts with third parties. It can all get quite complicated, as you can see.
Yes, indeed. And you've talked a bit about gathering evidence to establish who is entitled to claim. Can you expand a bit on what sort of evidence might be needed?
Yeah, sure. The evidence that will be needed to support the claim will be the same sort of things that you would need if the claimant was selling the property voluntarily on the open market. And it will probably be necessary to get solicitors involved to pull some of that together. So typically the documents that you're going to need will include title deeds, land registry documents showing other charges over the land, partnership agreements, tenancy agreements, possibly even wills where there's recently been a death. Getting all those documents together can reveal complications, as we've talked about just now, which is why it's good practice to start this process early. Where problems are identified, there might then be time for the parties to sort them out so that those affected by the scheme are in the best position to be able to make a claim. And for example, that could include the recording of informal arrangements, putting them onto a more formal footing, or ensuring that ownership and occupation are properly aligned in order to facilitate a claim being made.
In some of this, presumably the claimant might need other advice from their accountant, for example. So is it a good idea to bring them on board at this stage?
Yes. Yeah, it's really important to discuss that with the claimant and see whether they need other advice. So as you say, it could be tax advice or advice on restructuring the business, or even just to update their wills. You know, when you start asking people about these things, you might find that they haven't updated their wills for an awful long time. If so, then again, try and encourage the claimant to instruct those advisors early enough so that there's time to deal with everything before the compulsory acquisition goes ahead. If it's going to involve some restructuring, for example, it might take months to put new arrangements in place. So try to make sure the claimant doesn't put it off. Grasp that nettle. And I said earlier it was important to get solicitors on board early. I think it's just worth repeating that point. The claimant needs to ensure that the solicitors are engaged early enough in proceedings and given clear instructions to begin the task of collating all the information necessary to allow the property to be conveyed to the acquiring authority. Now, at that early stage, the claimant might not even know exactly when that conveyance is going to happen. But by keeping in touch with the acquiring authority, they will be able to monitor the timing of events.
And what other practical tips have you got?
Well, keeping information on ownership and occupation up to date is really important. Big infrastructure projects can run for many years, from the moment that they first start talking about possible routes to the time that they actually finish the contract and leave the site. It can take an awful long time. And inevitably, circumstances can change between the earliest land referencing and making the claim. So the information needs to be kept under review and checked at key stages during the acquisition process. And it's the claimant's responsibility to make the acquiring authority aware of any changes in ownership or occupation arrangements. It's also essential to all concerned that compensation is paid to the correct claimant on the correct valuation basis. Any errors can have serious implications, not least for advisors if incorrect information has been given. And another really practical point is to plan ahead to be ready to sign documents. When it comes to the actual transaction, claimants may need to be available to confirm or approve matters and sign documents. So it's important that they will be available and contactable at the right time. Remember that the whole reason for getting properly organised is so that the legal procedures required to transfer the property to the acquiring authority can be dealt with as efficiently as possible, so that in turn, the compensation money can be paid to the claimant as soon as possible.
It sounds as though there can be quite a lot of professional work involved in all of this. So will the claimant be able to recover the cost of those fees as a part of their claim?
They should be able to recover any fees which are directly connected to the acquisition, but they wouldn't be able to recover fees for other work, such as documenting those informal arrangements, for example. It's important that the valuer and the other professionals, if there are other professionals involved, set this out really clearly in their terms of engagement, together with the basis on which the fees will be charged. It should be made very clear to the client which work is directly connected to the acquisition and which is not, so that they're aware of the fees they're going to have to pay themselves. And then those arrangements should be notified to the acquiring authority. If you can get their prior approval on the principle and basis of the fees, so much the better. And for more guidance on fees, CAV members can turn to numbered publication 240, Professional Fees in Compensation Claims, and we published the second edition of that last year. CAV members will have a copy as part of their subscription, but non-members can also buy it through our website at www.caav.org.uk.
Yes, it's always a good idea to keep an eye on the CAV website, as there's so much information uploaded on there on a daily basis. Well, Kate, thank you for sharing your top CPO tips and helping claimants to get their ducks in a row. It's always a pleasure having you on the podcast, so thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Aled.
And there we are. We've reached the end of yet another episode of the CAV podcast. If you want to keep up to date with all future episodes, then please hit subscribe on whichever platform you use. So until the next time, on behalf of Kate Russell and myself, Aled Jones, thank you for listening and bye for now.